Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I'm joined by Eric, and we're going to be discussing Green Arrow, The Longbow Hunters by Mike Grell from 1987. Eric, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I am doing well. Now, this is a three-issue prestige format miniseries. It's, what, 40-ish pages per thereabouts? Maybe a little more? I didn't do a page count.
Yeah, I think it ends up being like, about 150 pages. If you count the covers in my omnibus. So, yeah, probably 40-ish pages each.
Yeah. So, three-issue miniseries. This was one of the early prestige format ones. They'd done The Dark Knight before this, and I'm not sure how many other prestige formats there were around this time.
Yeah, I don't think there were too many. And I think in each case, it was, you know, a special almost event or reason for making it a prestige. And this one is just to me, it's a visual feast. I like the way those three single issues stand together, the coloring that they chose on them, mm-hmm. and kind of how they look, you know, spine out or, you know, flat face. They look wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's Mike Grell, who's a terrific artist, a really good writer. And this took the Green Arrow character in a new direction, more of a kind of a back to basics sort of a thing, a ditching of the gimmick arrows. But it did it in a way without, like, tossing out previous continuity or anything. It just kind of made the character more grounded, more street level.
Yes. And, you know, as we were kind of talking a little before we started, you read this in the original three-issue format.
Yes.
And I read it out of the Green Arrow Longbow Hunter Saga Omnibus Volume 1. And obviously in yours, it was printed when it came out, whereas mine could be a little retrospective. So there's actually a number of pages at the front of prose written by Mike about kind of where he was, where his headspace was, where the stories came from. And I think it might be kind of fun to just read a little bit of that for folks to kind of set the tone, as it were. And then as we talk about some of the stuff later on, it'll tie back to it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm certainly curious what he had to say and kind of why some of the decisions were made.
Yeah, so basically it set out Mike Gold, who was the editor, was a good friend of Mike Grell's and asked him if he'd be willing to come back to DC after having left to do some independent publishing, things like John Sable, Freelance, Star Slayer, stuff like that. So mm-hmm. when Mike Gold reached out to Mike Grell, I can't even say Mike G because they're both the same. his basic sales pitch was, you know, tell me what character you think you want to write. And Mike's first thought was that he had done what he felt was an inferior job on Batman in the 70s, and then found out shortly thereafter with having dinner with Frank Miller that there was this whole concept of the Dark Knight Returns. And this was in the 70s that they talked about this. He said, well, when Frank is done, you can put a period at the end of the Batman sentence for the next 20 years. So he knew he wasn't going to do Batman, but Mike Gold had asked about Green Arrow. And through their discussion of what was going on, Mike Grell kind of realized that, yeah, you know what, growing up as a kid, he grew up just outside of Green Bay, Wisconsin, and very rural. And for him as a child, the idea of Robin Hood was something that he could really get into because he had lots of, you know, forest around him, and kind of the do good, but still be a little bit on edge was kind of exciting and fun. Whereas, you know, when he was reading Green Lantern, Green Arrow, there was always that straight laced Green Lantern who was by the books and everything and whatnot. So he kind of said, yeah, Green Arrow sounds good. But then Mike Gold and Mike Grell were talking, and the final pitch was Green Arrow as an urban hunter, was what Mike Gold had said to Mike Grell. And he said, yeah, I kind of like that idea. So when he started to think about what that would look like, it says, okay, I was hooked. But first, a few name changes were in order. For starters, the name of Green Arrow always struck me as a bit silly. Later in the story, I told how he got stuck with it, but for the moment, I chose not to call him anything but Oliver Queen. Mm-hmm. I moved Ollie from the mythical Star City and placed him in Seattle, Washington, which is something we'll talk about. The reason was twofold. One, that I wanted to place him firmly in the real world. The second was that I grew up in a small town about 100 miles north of Green Bay and had only ever lived in or near three big cities in my life: Chicago, where I attended art school, New York, where I had already used as a setting for Sable, and Seattle, where I was living at the time. It's best to write from personal knowledge in order to avoid stupid mistakes like mentioning, say, the homeless population on Rodeo Drive. So that was kind of, you know, why he chose Seattle. He goes, Seattle has an abundance of rain, which is why I gave Ollie long sleeves and proper trousers, the most distinctive costume element, the hood, which would eventually become his identifying trademark. So you get, you know, starting to see where things were coming together. And he said the next thing they had to go was his quiver full of trick arrows. Remember I said I shot a bow from the time I was a kid? I also had a boomerang, briefly. I carefully read the instructions, wound up, and gave it a hell of a throw. A long, graceful arc, rising, turning, and the damn thing nearly took my head off. The idea of an arrow that would do the same thing seemed just silly. Not to mention the lockpicking arrow. I replaced his takedown recurve bow with an old-fashioned long bow and real arrows, the pointy kind. So then he kind of, there's a little bit more in there, but I'm going to finish it off by saying, a lot of the general plot came from local and national headlines. One element involved the hunt for a serial killer, inspired by an actual case. Another involved the CIA. And after the Longbow Hunters was released, I received a phone call from a New York radio station wanting to know if I'd be willing to go on the air and talk about how it was that I managed to beat the Oliver North Iran-Contra drugs for guns scandal into print by 6 months. I said all I did was take the general situation, plug in all the characters, and ask myself what would be the stupidest thing these guys could do if they were dead certain they'd never get caught. He goes, I've recently revised my theory somewhat. We know the NSA had a bunch of other anagram outfits monitor everything that goes into print. And since there was a 6 month lead time from the book, when the book was completed and the publishing date, I can picture some guy in Washington phoning Oliver North and saying, I've got an idea for you. And the guy's name is even Ollie. So kind of a little fun backstory. There's a lot more written that I didn't read, but I think mm-hmm. those are some of the key points where, you know, we see, to your point, John, getting rid of the trick arrows,
yeah.
you know, moving to Seattle, which is different than Star City, again, grounds it in reality. Even the name Green Arrow going to Oliver Queen and focusing more on that, you know, it's a tone change, right? It's kind of less of the yuck yuck, you know, goofy arrows and more of the street sense, smart Oliver Queen. I mean, Robin Hood was called Robin Hood. He wasn't, you know, anything else. And then just the idea of plots being derived from more local and real world happening events, you know, it almost feels a little bit like some of the older Marvel stuff, you know, that was taken straight out of
yeah.
New York. So
well, it's funny because there are aspects of this that I think they kind of thematically pulled for the Arrow TV show. A few things mm-hmm. they didn't that kind of surprised me. But the whole focus on Oliver versus, you know, the name Green Arrow and stuff like that, absolutely. Everything from the hood, the look of the character, the use of real arrows, the urban hunter stuff, they totally used for the Arrow TV show. The parts they didn't use here, and I don't know when the last time I reread this was, or if I've reread it since it first came out. I probably have, I just don't remember. But certainly not since the Arrow show started. But man, if I were doing an Arrow show from scratch and had just read this, I would definitely have pulled Dinah Lance as the florist, particularly the Sherwood Florist Store.
Yeah. Yep.
And, you know, I loved how in the course of the first issue, it kind of retells, kind of retcons the origin a little. It doesn't yeah. change the broad brushstrokes, but it does a much more believable kind of real world-ish version with the, and once the media got a hold of it, it went wild to kind of explain that the other story is still out there in this universe.
Correct.
You know, and ditching the gimmick arrows, the compound bow, going for the longbow, just symbolic of a simpler back to basics kind of approach or whatever. This, I think, is one of the unsung heroes of how to retool a character.
Oh yeah, I mean, when I read this, I get so many familiar vibes to writers like Alan Moore, people who can take a character who either, you know, maybe wasn't viewed as seriously as it could be or should be, and with respect to its history and what makes the character, weave a new story that can reset it without losing the historical baggage,
mm-hmm.
but give it so much opportunity and so much, I guess, forward momentum that can set a storyline for many, many years to come. This isn't like, this is a 3-issue arc, but it's a 3-issue arc that sets up years of wonderful Green Arrow after it. It wasn't just done for 3 issues for a quick hit, and then now we reset and start over.
Oh, this was essentially the pilot 2-hour episode, if you will, for mm-hmm. the character at the time. And I would argue it doesn't set it so much for years, but decades.
Right.
I mean, I think there's a strong case to be made that this is still the current version of the character, what, 33 years later or something?
Yeah.
And you look at how many times characters get rebooted, restarted, retooled, or whatever. That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a wonderful achievement, and it's a feast both to read and to look at.
Yeah. Well, and there were a couple of things that I again, not having reread this in ages, I really enjoyed, particularly in the first issue, you know, Oliver proposing to Dinah. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, it takes, I was going to say years, but really it takes decades, but they do eventually marry.
Correct.
I don't know if that's still considered in continuity or not, but, you know, who cares? DC's doing what they're doing.
We'll call it whatever we want to call it at the time.
Yeah. The part I found hilarious as a now much older reader than I was in 87 is Oliver's going through a little bit of a, I don't say an identity crisis, but at this point, his sidekick Speedy has had a kid. So Oliver's mm-hmm. feeling like a grandparent. Yet he's 43 at this point.
Right. And, you know, I think is really that right there is one of those pieces that Mike brings in. And this is, it's still the same character, right? You're still connecting to the past. You've got Speedy, you've got Dinah.
Mm-hmm.
There's even a snippet, a call out to, you know, one of Speedy's past transgressions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's all there. It's real. And it has heavy weight to it. And I think the first time I read this, I was either engaged or newly married. I didn't have a child at that point. And reading it since then, there's a lot more weight. I mean, this is one of those books where you can read it multiple times and you're going to pick up on something different, or it's going to hit you in a different way based on where you're at in your life and what you're doing and what you're experiencing. I mean, as we kind of go through this, there's just some real, almost heart-wrenching, but like, believable. Like you can relate to it. You can understand why what was written was written. And it almost is one of those things where like, is this reality or is this fiction? It weaves so close together.
Well, and one of the places where I felt it really grounded the characters really well was Oliver, again, has proposed. Mm-hmm. He wants kids. Dinah doesn't.
Right.
And what a real world kind of thing for a couple to have to grapple with. And
oftentimes it's almost the reverse because, you know, women just hormonally hit a certain age where they get into this kind of, they're ready. Like their body mm-hmm. has made a transition and emotionally, mentally, hormonally, they're ready to have kids. And so to have it flipped and have it be the man who is ready and the woman who's like, no, I'm not. I mean, in 1987, that would have been huge to have a woman almost say like, no, I'm going after my career. And this is going to have to wait.
Well, and also, they live dangerous lives. She wants kids, but not orphans.
And that was the line where it was like, holy smokes. Like, that's a pretty powerful line. You know, I want to have your babies, but I don't want to have orphans.
Well, and Grell was treating these characters essentially, well, not literally, as first responders and the risk and responsibilities that go with that.
Yeah.
And this read very differently, I think, in 87 versus today, because Oliver's son, Connor Hawke, wasn't created until like 1994.
Right.
So he had no legacy of his own at that point. Now, Connor's come and gone a few times in the comics and whatnot since then. Matter of fact, I think it took a while for him to get used after the new 52 reboot. But, you know, reading this as it was, and I was trying to remember as I was rereading this, what the status quo for, you know, Black Canary and Green Arrow was prior to this. And I'm thinking it was just satellite era JLA adventures.
Yeah.
I mean, he'd had a miniseries, I want to say in the 80s, but it's not like, and maybe backup feature over in Detective before this, but it's not like he was an A-list character.
Right.
So they had the freedom to do this retooling. I appreciated them not throwing the continuity out in the process, but reinterpreting it, retooling it, and giving a, what I think even in 87 would have worked as a primetime TV show fairly well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, now this, there are aspects of this that they absolutely did not and should not have pulled for Arrow, because over the course of this 3-issue series, there's some stuff that gets pretty heavy and I think inappropriate for a you know, primetime TV show.
Yes.
Particularly on the CW and stuff, because there's some stuff that it fundamentally, I think, changed the character after a while. And a lot of that goes to the kind of, I can't even call it a subplot, but Black Canary's, or actually Dinah, is going after drug dealers. It's almost all off-panel and stuff, while Oliver's going after a killer or two and such. And this, again, starts feeling like, I don't know, not typical primetime procedural, you know, type stuff, but, you know, they've got their cases, they're working, we've got the at-home drama in between and whatnot.
Right.
But, again, he's treating this not as a sensationalistic superhero fantasy adventure thing, but how might this play out in the quote-unquote real world?
Yeah, and I think that that really, it gives the reader almost a closer attachment to the story. Like, there's almost, you're almost invested in it because these are real places. And I would imagine that the serial killer that we're going after was, you know, made after the Green River Killer,
mm-hmm.
which is just like so wild because the Green River Killer was a comic book fan. You can actually, it is one of the pedigrees that CGC has, is the Green River Collection.
Oh, wow.
So like the parallels of pulling in an actual Pacific Northwest serial killer into the book, mind you, that this was, you know, mid-80s, 86, 87 when it was being written. He started in 82 and wasn't, you know, was active through the into the 90s, killing people. But to have a serial killer from the area who was a comic book fan himself, it's just kind of weird how that all works together. And obviously, I don't think anyone knew that the Green River Killer was a comic book reader because they didn't even know who he was.
Yeah. Well, there's a ripped from the headlines aspect of some of these plots.
Right.
Not in a sensationalistic way, but in a, this has happened in the real world. This is now happening in this comic book world.
Yep.
Here's how this character is dealing with that.
Yep. And you see, like, in this, just the right off the bat in the first issue, the first couple of pages while they're setting the scene, it's just all these, you know, the backgrounds are all these places in Seattle. You've got the Public Market. You've got, you know, the Space Needle, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And just scenes from the streets that are realistic. And it wasn't that far along in when, you know, Ollie gets the clue that this person needs, this slasher he's looking for is underground. And the first couple of times I read this, I had not been to Seattle. And since, I have gone multiple times to Seattle. And as I was, you know, reading it again and looking at the pages, sure enough, where he's walking down to the underground, or the long panel that is across the top of the pages that shows this thick street layer, and there's a complete underground. And I've seen that, because mm-hmm. that's one of the things you can do there is take the underground tour. And they tell you why the whole city had to be built one level up and why everything was preserved underneath. And even little things like when Ollie's walking down the stairs to go underground, and above his head, there's these glass squares that are letting light through. Those are there. You can walk on those when you're on the sidewalks in Seattle, because that's how they were able to get light down to that lower level before there was things like, you know, readily available electricity to just pump lights everywhere. So the attention to detail and the ability for people who have either visited or been to these places, and even if you haven't, you can be there because it's realistic.
Yeah. Well, and setting it in, you know, his hometown, so to speak, makes a lot of sense for those exact reasons.
Right.
If you've got somebody who, in this case, is writing and drawing the story and knows the city or those aspects well enough, it totally can ground it. Even if you've never been to the city, it gives it a consistency, a realism and such.
Yep.
I've got to say, though, one of the things I loved in terms of the physical reality of the thing was the tour of Sherwood Florist shop and living quarters and such.
Yeah. Yep.
And
Dinah's level, Ollie's level, and then their level together.
Yeah. Well, and also the turret kind of staircase thing and stuff like that.
Yep.
It was a distinctive design. It, again, the name of the florist shop really fits. I mean, he's all but eventually, you know, kind of advertising, I'm here sort of a deal.
Yep.
And it, again, feels very much like the pilot episode of an ongoing series of, let me give you the lay of the land, we'll have our first adventure, and then we'll go for as long as this can go. And the series that followed this, it went for, man, how long did that go? I want to say,
there's at least another omnibus coming after this one, and this one contains through issue 50.
I think it went for like 130, 140 issues or so.
Yeah, something like that.
Add in however many annuals, that would be probably a special event issue or two here and there. And I'm trying to think why that series ended eventually. And it may have just, you know, rotated over into another volume or something.
I'm trying to think how big of a gap. Was there much of a gap between this and The Brightest Day, Darkest Night? I think The Wedding was wedged in there, wasn't it?
I think there was a series after this that went 75 issues or something and then flipped over into the series that went on around the time of the New 52 reboot, give or take a volume.
Boy, Comic Book DB would be nice to have.
Yeah, I am upset they shut that down without an immediate replacement, and it's been almost 2 years now, so...
Okay.
They've let us down big time.
So this would have been volume...
Well, I think this would have been volume... Well, Longbow Hunters was its own thing, but then the ongoing series after that would have been the... Depends how you count. That's why I don't do volume numbers. There was the four-issue miniseries back in the early 80s. Then right. I think the series after this was really the first ongoing Green Arrow series I'm aware of.
Yeah, so this would have been technically volume 2, issues 1 through 137 through November of 98. Then there was volume 3, which went for 75 issues from 2001 to 2007. And then Green Arrow and Black Canary, 1 through 32, that followed up volume 3 and was a gap until volume 4.
I was thinking, was there another Green Arrow series like before or after the Green Arrow Black Canary one? Because they did some crazy renumbering stuff. Either way, the character has had a fairly recurring series, and I put him firmly in that B-list category of he's not Superman, he's not Batman, he's not always going to have a series, but he's like the next round of characters to be considered for one. And it'll go... For as long as it goes, in some cases that'll be, you know, years and years and years. Other times it'll fade away and he may go a couple of years without one.
Yeah. Green Arrow Year One, the 6-issue mini, came right before Green Arrow and Black Canary.
Okay.
I don't know if that's it. And then the other one, yeah, I think that's might be what you were thinking of. But either way. Yeah, so this was the first this kicked off the first real long running Green Arrow volume.
Mm-hmm. Well, and how long was Grell on that series?
Ooh, boy, that's a good question.
That was one of the complaints I had about Comic Book DB is when they'd give the list of issues, it's like, come on, guys, include another column of the writer and the artist at least. So
let's find out. The Google knows 80 issues.
80 issues, wow, yeah. So the majority of the run.
Right.
And, I mean, he redefined the character and without it being a radical reinterpretation. And that's kind of what I love. It's easy for somebody to go in and chuck everything and start from scratch. But to do it of I'm relocating the character so I can reset a few things, grounding the character, new costume, but still, while it's different than the old, it's recognizable from the old, if you know what I mean.
Right.
It's an evolutionary costume, not a revolutionary costume.
Yeah, and in addition to the costume was kind of Oliver's features, you know, the long kind of pointed goatee, the mustache, you know, like real pronounced was kind of...
He'd kind of had that for a while, though.
But I feel like it was much more, I don't know, kind of like looked aggressive with Grell. Like it was made... So I kind of the way I think about it is the way that Oliver was feeling about himself was he had killed someone and he didn't want to kill anyone ever again.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't who he wanted to be. And I kind of felt like that in the costume, right? Robin Hood, who... Well, at times would kill people. You know, he was really there to rob from the rich, give to the poor, more of a gentler feel. But then he still had, with the way that Grell had kind of defined his face and the facial hair, still had that edginess, kind of that gruff, that appearance of being able to handle his business how he needed to. And just the two played together.
This gave us a more weathered version of the character, I think.
Yeah. Well, and remember, he's 43. He's old.
Yeah, again, different perspective on that than when I first read it as a kid.
Yep. Yeah, and I wonder too, like, you know, you talked about there's some events that were happening and he's kind of matured. And I think you could almost put some of this up to part of the recentering happening like a midlife crisis.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really the part of I want to be a father. I'm ready now. And it's just kind of that realization that if it doesn't happen soon, it's probably not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. It was a good take on the character, a good repositioning and such. And, you know, this first issue also introduced Shadow, who's been an on and off, you know, pivotal character for the Green Arrow mythos since. I gotta say, I loved the bit in the second issue where he goes to the police with what he's found about what was the Robin Hood killer, I think they call it.
Yeah.
And, you know, setting up the relationship he's gonna have with the police and stuff of, you know, they really don't want his help, you know, thanks for visiting, but go back home. And he's like, what makes you think I'm visiting?
Yeah. Yep.
You know, there's a fine line between this guy accepting a Justice Leaguer's help and really wanting him the hell out of his city.
Right.
And it made a lot of sense, you know, because you don't want the grief and the craziness that goes with having a local Justice Leaguer, but sometimes nice to have the help.
Exactly. And I even, you know, for me, as a kid, I grew up surrounded by mysteries, and my mom loved watching Murder, She Wrote, and so I, you know, would watch it with her, and I loved watching it. And it was almost kind of that same feel there where Angela Lansbury's character would be in some other city, or even in Cabot Cove, mm-hmm. and she'd be, you know, solving the murder, and the police would be like, lady, get out of here. We don't need your help. And it was, you know, very obvious that these people couldn't, you know, find one end from where the other started. And so it was up to this, you know, older woman to solve these mysteries. And it almost kind of rang that same sort of feeling of like, yeah, you're here, but clearly you aren't able to do it, or you'd have probably solved it by now. So maybe you need my help. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's nice.
Well, but there's also the case of, you know, in Cabot Cove, is the crime rate way down when she's out of town?
Yeah, right. It just happens to balloon when she's there.
You know, when Oliver Queen moved to Seattle, you know, what was the crime rate before and after?
Right. I think the only other thing that I would say is they did call out a couple of times in here that Oliver's not the police. He doesn't mm-hmm. have to play by the same rules. And it's like, that was a clear distinction. And you know, sometimes you, in these stories, you could see where that could be very useful.
Yeah. On both sides.
Yes.
I was surprised how much of Dinah going after the drug dealers was just totally off panel and such.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, so I guess actually it's probably worth noting this omnibus is not through the standard DC line. This is their Black Label. And the boundary gets fuzzy for me as to where Black Label is versus their standard DC branding, because clearly this is continuity. I mean, there's no question about it. There's a lot in yeah. this whole Grell run that's continuity. So the Black Label was typically a non-continuity thing. The only thing I can think is that, you know, part of the story is more mature, graphic, whatever you want to say, you know, where Dinah's
Absolutely.
Strung up. And I'm wondering if that was what tipped the scales to make this a Black Label omnibus.
I think so, because, you know, in this issue, Dinah gets captured. She's being tortured. Ollie kills a man. Well, actually, probably two or three others. And it got kind of graphic and intense in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to the point of, okay, I'm flipping to the next page kind of quickly sort of deal. And I think that's where the rating of this is not, you know, all ages, nor should it be kind of a deal. And again, the Black Label thing, I think, is just horribly ill-defined and such. But I wonder if they had toned this down, if it could have been a little more, well, I was going to say, you couldn't, the stuff they did with Black Canary and Dinah and stuff of and whatnot, if you take that out, if you downplay that, it does change the story.
Right. It kind of fuels the rage.
Well, it fuels the rage. It gets him to the killing point, but it also gets him to the acceptance point of her not wanting kids.
Right.
I mean, at that point, he gets it. Not to say he's right. happy with it by any means, but it was one of those things that in this issue, so much happens. There's a couple of pages. There's like one about halfway through. No dialogue, no captions, nothing. And Grell yep. knew when to let the art tell the story.
Yep.
You know? And then we get a great, you know, kind of two-page thing with him facing off with Shadow and such.
Yep.
And there was aspects of kind of a Western, you know, gunfighter in the middle of town sort of feeling to it. It just, the cinematic aspect of this really felt like a kind of a dark suspense movie, if you know what I mean, at times.
Yeah, and this, so to me, these are the kinds of comics that I absolutely love to read. And it doesn't necessarily have to take place in, you know, like a real world city. Gotham can have the same kind of effect.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate stories that have depth and an impact. You know, even single issue stories can have that. Like Astro City's half issue is half an issue, and yeah. it has depth and severe impact. You know, it's all about writing, and these are the kind of stories that they stick with you. You remember them because there is something that's going to come out of this, and there are pieces in these three issues, and again, you know, written as an arc, but there is in each issue there is a major consequence that is being worked through. I think one piece that we've kind of glossed over a little bit is really all of the sidebar commentary about Shadow.
Mm.
And just how beautifully it's all rendered, kind of in the margins, in most cases, about her upbringing.
Yeah.
And how the text is almost written in a different tone. You could totally see it, this being, you know, like a flashback video sequence, you know, very calm. You hear water just gently rushing, you know,
mm-hmm.
And this little girl being trained to basically be a killer. And just the sorts of words that are being used as she's growing up, you do not take the shot takes the shot, right? All those things that great action movies and kung fu movies, you know, the Karate Kid, all those little things, those little, you know, phrases that you come accustomed to hearing that essentially lead to take your mind off of what you're doing and just let repetition take over kind of thing. And you see this girl grow into a woman, and then you start to understand the background story of why she was groomed to do what she was doing.
Yeah.
All the while inside the pages, you know, within the margins, you have some pretty heavy conflict going on between, you know, the drug trade and what's happening and how Ollie's trying to help bring that down. And so he's kind of got like all these different things happening at once. And so I just thought that the way the art was rendered as more hazy for Shadow's background versus the vivid colors and the sharp edges. It's just beautiful choice.
Absolutely. And she was so well defined in these issues. And there's an aspect where I kind of wish they were doing the animated features that they do these days back then, because there's a couple of like Mako, the character actor and stuff, would have been great as her kind of teacher and such of, you know, you don't take the shot takes you, those kinds of things that, you know, not around anymore. There are other actors and stuff, but there's an aspect of her backstory, her upbringing, that is both cinematic, iconic, and original, too.
Right.
You know, it's familiar, but again, they do such a great job setting her up. And I'm trying to remember the last time she was really used in the comics, because I think she was one that kind of got a little bit cast aside with the New 52. And I think that, if that's true, and it may or may not be, I just don't remember, there's so much you could do with this character.
Yeah, and this is another case, too, where, you know, Mike did his homework, you know, bringing the Yakuza in, bringing the symbol of the dragon on her mm-hmm. sleeve, her arm, and, you know, really drawing from what's real, changing a few things here and there, like the color of the dragon or whatever, but just the idea of that, again, real world grounding, it makes sense. And I bet you there's a number of people who read some of this and got interested in wanting to know more about certain things. And it spawned them to go and, you know, do some research and look. And I think that, again, that's a good story that can make you do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, having something that's got the grounding in reality, not to say it's got to be an uber realistic story. I mean, we're talking about a, you know, an urban, you know, archer, you know, hunting down people and stuff,
right.
that's not realistic, nor do I want it to be, kind of a thing.
Right. But the way it's portrayed, it's believable.
Exactly. To make it so believable, to make it so understandable and not feel so fantastic and I don't say, it doesn't have the shiny Saturday morning superhero feel to it, if you know what I mean.
Right. Right.
And I think that's why this is one of the few retoolings of a character that stuck as long as it has. I mean, sure, we've gotten a few times where maybe we've had the Trick Arrows back or whatever, but not as the signature part of the character. And I think there's aspects of this Oliver Queen that are being leveraged in the recent Checkmate stuff they've been doing. Or not Checkmate, Leviathan stuff they've been doing.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it comes down to, as readers, you know, everybody likes, well, I think a lot of us read comics that are fiction to have that escape, right? We want to
mm-hmm.
escape the reality, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that we need to totally remove ourselves from reality. Maybe the reality is changed as to how something is solved or whodunit or whatever in this case, right? So we've got the Green River Killer. Now we're talking about, at the very beginning of this three-issue arc, a slasher, right? So it's taking something from reality, but changing it, changing the outcome. So it's separating us from it. And I think that the storytelling that Mike put into these three issues, it sets it so far and away from a lot of other content that especially today comes out, where there is full-on consequence to everything that's happening. We talked about how Ollie got the reality check when Dinah was in the hospital after, you know, going through the ordeal that she did. Mm-hmm. And then we come full circle at the very end, you know, with Dinah coming back around to the idea of having kids and, you know, not necessarily changing her stance on it, but re-highlighting to Oliver that she hears it, she understands it, and, you know, she's open to it someday. You know, it's just kind of that full circle.
I think this was also the storyline that kind of took Black Canary out of action for a while, because it took her a while to kind of emotionally heal up from the events of the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was one of the ongoing arcs in the follow-up Green Arrow series of when was she ready to get back out there.
Right.
So they did a lot of things that had kind of lasting consequences here. And again, not only did they introduce Shadow in the course of this story, but they also introduced Eddie Fries, or Fires, however you want to pronounce that. And he became a long-time supporting cast member in the Green Arrow stuff.
Yep.
Matter of fact, he hung out with Connor Hawk when he took over at one point.
Right.
So, and I think Eddie was also used in the Arrow series at one point. But there's just so much going on here, including when the police, it's like, okay, we found a couple of arrowheads, and they sure look like two different types, you mm-hmm. know, but I guess we'll never know for sure. Kind of, I'm pretty sure you killed two of those people, but I kind of understand why, sort of a thing.
Yeah, yeah, we're going to let this one slide.
Yeah, they deserve to die. They were probably going to get killed by the state anyway, sort of a deal, so yeah. But that, again, sets a definite tone and relationship that he has with the cops. If he gets some leeway, but only so much.
Right, yep. Yeah, and it's really from that point on, after Dinah's rescued, the fire, that it really comes down to essentially Oliver hunting for Shadow and Shadow working to continue her mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, we get another great showdown with those two, with just some great cinematic and artistic flair to it that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who hasn't really read any of Grell's work, this is a great starting point. I would also point to the original Warlord series.
Yep.
The guy is just a master storyteller. And it's funny, because in one of these pages, we've got her facing off with him. We've got the arrows behind them. I think it's like page 26 of the third issue. And at the bottom, we've got two panels kind of looking at Oliver with a more kind of penciled art style. And there's a definite change in the look of the character between the two. One of them is evocative of the more happy-go-lucky version. The other one is the more, you know, I have killed, and if I have to, I'll do it again kind of take on the character, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So just to have that kind of nuance to the art and stuff is just awesome.
And I love how frequently Mike uses the eyes.
Yes.
You know, this isn't the first spread where we see her eyes and his eyes. I mean, it's a couple of times earlier as well, just kind of showing, like, you know, they're staring each other down. This is not just a, you know, just a random walk by. Like you said, it's kind of the showdown at the OK Corral.
Mm-hmm. And again, just some amazing artwork there. Just incredible.
Mm-hmm.
I did find the whole bit at the end when we get the drugs for money kind of stuff going on, and how that kind of resolved itself of, he can't really put them up on charges. They can't really do anything about him. And he winds up with a bit of a windfall out of this.
Right, right. Clean money. You know, might as well do something with it. Yeah.
So I thought that was interesting, because that's one of those where, you know, is he taking blood money or not? It, you know, and what does he do with it later, sort of deal.
Right.
But I think this was such a solid setup for an ongoing series that I'm not the least bit surprised the thing ran 7-8 years or something.
Exactly.
which, again, Green Arrow is a great character, but he's not the upper echelon of the DC stuff. He's that next tier down. So for this character to have a run after this that goes the 137 issues or whatnot, that says a lot of the strength of what Grell set up here.
Right. And, you know, I think, I don't know for certain, and I don't know if we have the numbers that we could actually say it, but, you know, based on what collections come into the store and what we get, when people are divesting of their collections, they'll have, you know, if they're a DC fan, of course, they've got Batman, probably either Wonder Woman or Superman, or maybe both, Action and Superman. But in almost every collection, we're getting this era, this run, and then Kevin Smith, Green Arrow.
Mm-hmm.
They almost always come in. And, you know, based on that, you know, I have to make an educated guess that at the very least, being in Wisconsin, Mike Grell was from here, it was a popular title here. But I would think across the board, this was a popular title. After people probably heard about the gravity of this initial 3-issue arc, you know, coming to a title that actually has consequence, has meaning, has some weight to it, I could understand why people would jump on. And even though it's not their A-list characters, their Trinity, certainly in a strong position, and no different than when Alan Moore took over Swamp Thing, you know, a book that was kind of relegated to its fandom, but, you know, relatively smaller as far as distribution goes, to, you know, not too many issues after Alan Moore starts his run, where it becomes one of the, you know, better selling titles in the DC stable. Because again, there is consequence, there's depth of character, there is, you know, growth of a cast around, and really, again, just that solid writing. And so to read this again now after a couple more years, and to look at it, it's such a wonderful piece of time because of the era that it came from, but mm-hmm. it stands up against time. You know,
absolutely.
Robin Hood will always stand the test of time. Whether he's in Sherwood Forest and Nottingham, and you've got, you know, a king as a lion in an animated feature by Disney, or you're reading, you know, the more true original stories and text, or this, Robin Hood stands the test of time. And Green Arrow, Oliver Queen, in that role without trick arrows, can very easily stand the test of time.
Well, yeah, I think Grell's work here and on the ongoing series after it was a kind of, I don't know what the right term would be, a signature run, definitive run, marquee run, whatever, but for both him and for the character.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at his body of work, which is fairly large, at DC, I would say this and Warlord are probably the two at the top of the list of great runs, things people should read, etc. And he's done, again, a ton of work. You look elsewhere, he's got, you know, the John Sable stuff, some other creator-owned things. But I think the work he did here, not only, you know, was a great run in of itself, but again, I don't think they veered very far away from this most of the time since. And when they do, they kind of course-correct back. I mean, I think the beginning of the new 52 run was a little bit more the trick arrow, that kind of a thing. But I think they wound up, you know, particularly where they're at right now in the DC universe, back more towards this version of the character.
Yeah, and I think this story that we just read, you know, it was gritty, it was dark,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't, I don't know what to say, like, there were moments of sun, there were moments of brightness. And so it wasn't just all this depressive kind of ongoing story. It was dark when it needed to be to get the reader in the right mindset. And then when the opportunity, you know, was there for brightness, it came. And I don't feel that as much with a lot of what is out in the stands right now. When it's dark, it's dark.
Yeah.
You know, there's very little bright.
Well, this, I don't want to say it was a much more realistic approach, because I hate that kind of a term for superheroish stuff. It's a more grounded approach to the character.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely more darker in places, much more nuanced in a lot of places, but I don't feel it's overly grim and gritty.
Right.
Because like you said, it's got its moments of humor, it's got its moments of light. It ends on one of those of, you know, we came out of this, we're okay, we're not unscathed, but we're still here to fight the good fight kind of thing.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's great stuff. Now, that having been said, I don't want all of my comics like this, because it'd get a bit much. This was, you know, in a few places, a little too heavy, a little too intense at times.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the quality of it, absolutely, I would love something that was this well-written, this well-drawn. And granted, Grell was writing and drawing it. He
right.
had some people helping on the art, but that gave it a unified vision that is often lacking in comics.
Correct.
So it's a 3-issue story. Granted, they're, you know, essentially double-sized issues. If you're curious about this run, this is a great starting point. If you're looking for something that's a little bit more sophisticated, maybe is the best word, than, you know, the flashy, bright, you know, Saturday morning style comics or whatnot, not that anyone's doing those these days, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That's more what it was, you know, if you went to what where he was used most before, it would be Satellite Era Justice League. That was akin to stories you theoretically could have found on a Saturday morning at some point. And then they took it and went a little bit more kind of a prime time approach or something.
Right.
So it was a great story, great to reread. There are a few stories from the ongoing series that I have recollections of that could be fun to reread, particularly when Warlord crossed over or guest starred.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if Hawkman or Green Lantern ever did. And we might have had Hal Jordan. I don't know that we ever would have had Green Lantern as such, because it would have felt a little out of place. But I think pairing with Hawkman in this run, if they did that, would be fun.
Yeah, I can't remember. I do think that, boy, that's a good question. Or is it maybe an annual that might have happened?
I don't know. It's been long enough since I've read this, and most of the recollections I've got of the ongoing series after it were more around issue 100 and stuff when they introduced Connor as Green Arrow.
Yeah.
But if they didn't pull in Hawkman at some point, who has a similar primitive hunter kind of aspect at times, that was a missed opportunity. Because those two were so often paired up in the Justice League days.
Right.
Of just having very diametrically opposed mindsets and such. But given the literally down-to-earth nature of this, having a guy with wings and stuff would feel a little off.
Yep.
I know at one point they teamed up Connor with one of the Green Lanterns. I know Kyle at one point, I don't know if he ever teamed up with any of the previous ones. But definitely this series gave, like I said, a firm foundation for the series that followed it for, you know, years and years afterwards.
Right.
So glad you recommended this. This was definitely a fun read.
Yeah, and I think the only real tragedy out of all of this is that the trade of these three issues is long out of print. And really the only way to get the full story collected right now is in omnibus format, which is just, that's a hefty price if somebody just wants to read the three issues. I did do a little bit of research, and you know, if your local comic store has the three issues, that's awesome. You can pick them up on eBay between $15 and $20 with shipping to get the three standalone issues. So I would highly recommend, if folks are interested, doing that, because it is it's a phenomenal run. Even the dialogue is fantastic and the art is just as good.
Yeah.
So if you're an art fan or a story fan, you're going to be satisfied with either.
I mean, there are a few aspects of the story, the whole drug deal, all that kind of, you know, and the serial killer type stuff, that do feel a little 80s, because that was, you know, again, what was in the news at the time. But they hold up.
Right.
They work well today as well. So, yeah, definitely some great stuff. I do think if people are either a fan of Mike Grell or Green Arrow or willing to sample, it's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, or fan of the CW shows, like The Tone.
Mm-hmm.
That would definitely hit. And also, if you're more of that street level, maybe a Marvel fan looking for something to dip their toe in that feels a little more familiar than, you know, the Hope and Bright and kind of the typical DC universe pre-New 52, this would be a good piece to read.
Yeah, I'd kind of say if you were a fan maybe of like Daredevil.
Yep.
I mean, the obvious go-to would be Hawkeye, but really I think it's more tonally like a Daredevil.
Yeah,
comic.
I would agree. I would very much agree.
So,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, thanks for humoring me in reading this. I know we were kind of going back and forth, and I really wanted a reason to read something here on well, what is my Christmas break, so to speak. And we bantied back and forth on a couple of different titles.
Uh-huh.
Looking for something a little bit, I would say, you know, in air quotes, older.
Mm-hmm.
And something that was, you know, had some substance to it. And this came to our minds, and I'm just so glad that we did choose it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, when you had said some Grell Green Arrow, it's like, well, this is the obvious starting.
Yeah, I just had a feeling that, you know, something like this would be a good place to go.
Absolutely. Definitely a good call.
Awesome.
Anything else?
No, I don't think I have anything else to add.
All right. Cool.
Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website. The deadline is typically the second Saturday of the month at 9 a.m. Check the main page of the website for more information and the exact deadline for the next preview spotlight.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.